Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Chapter 9 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 9. It was wonderful. The masterly Satan had over time and distance, for they did not exist. He called them human inventions and said they were artificialities. We often went to the most distant parts of the globe with him and stayed weeks and months, and yet were gone only a fraction of a second as a rule. Well, you could prove it by the clock. One day, when our people were in such awful distress because the witch commission were afraid to proceed against the astrologer and Father Peter's household, or against any, indeed, but the poor and the friendless, they lost patience and took to witch hunting on their own score, and began to chase a born lady who was known to have the habit of curing people by devilish arts, such as bathing them, washing them, and nourishing them, instead of bleeding them and purging them through the ministrations of the barber surgeon in the proper way. She came flying down with the howling and cursing mob after her, and tried to take refuge in houses, but the doors were shut in her face. They chased her more than half an hour. We were following to see it, and at last she was exhausted and fell, and they caught her. They dragged her to a tree and threw a rope over the limb and began to make a noose in it, some holding her meantime, and she crying and begging, and her young daughter looking on and weeping, but afraid to say or do anything. They hanged the lady, and I threw a stone at her, although in my heart I was sorry for her. But all were throwing stones, and each was watching his neighbor, and if I had not done as the others did, it would have been noticed and spoken of. Oh, Satan, well, he burst out laughing. All that were nearby turned upon him, astonished and not pleased. It was an ill time to laugh, for his free and scoffing ways and his supernatural music had brought him under suspicion all over the town, and turned many, well, privately, against him. The big blacksmith called attention to him now, raising his voice so that all should hear, and he said,
What are you laughing at? Answer! Moreover, please explain to the company why you threw no stone.
Are you sure I did not throw a stone?
Yes. You needn't try to get out of it. I had my eye on you.
And I noticed you,
shouted to others.
Three witnesses, said Satan. Mueller, the blacksmith, Klein, the butcher's man, Pfeiffer, the weaver's journeyman. Three very ordinary liars. Are there any more?
Never mind whether there are others or not, and never mind about what you consider us. Three's enough to settle the matter for you. You'll prove that you threw a stone, or it shall go hard for you.
Oh, that's so, shouted the crowd, and surged up as closely as they could get to the center of interest.
And first you will answer that other question,
cried the blacksmith, pleased with himself for being mouthpiece to the public and hero of the occasion.
What are you laughing at?
Satan smiled and answered pleasantly.
Oh, to see three cowards stoning a dying lady when they were so near death themselves.
Oh, you could see the superstitious crowd shrink and catch their breath under the sudden shock.
The blacksmith, with a show of bravado, said,
"Oh, Apu, what do you know about it?"
I? Everything. By profession, I am a fortune teller, and I read the hands of you three, and some others, when you lifted them to stone the woman. One of you will die tomorrow week, another of you will die tonight, and the third has but 5 minutes to live. And yonder is the clock.
Oh, it made a sensation. The faces of the crowd blanched and turned mechanically towards the clock. The butcher and the weaver seemed smitten with an illness. But the blacksmith braced up and said, with spirit,
"It's not long to wait for prediction number one. If it fails, young master, you will not live a whole minute after. I promise you that."
No one said anything. All watched the clock in a deep stillness which was impressive. When 4.5 minutes were gone, the blacksmith gave a sudden gasp and clapped his hand upon his heart, saying,
"Give me breath, give me room," and began to sink down.
The crowd surged back, no one offering to support him, and he fell, lumbering to the ground, and was dead.
Oh, the people stared at him,
then at Satan, then at one another, and their lips moved, but no words came. Then Satan said,
"Three saw that I threw no stone. Perhaps there are others. Let them speak."
It struck a kind of panic into them, and although no one answered him, many began to violently accuse one another, saying, "Oh, you said he didn't throw it," and getting for reply, "It's a lie, I will make you eat it." And so in a moment they were in a raging and noisy turmoil, and beating and banging one another, and in the midst was the only indifferent one. The dead lady hanging from the rope, her troubles forgotten, her spirit at peace. So we walked away, and I was not at ease,
but was saying to myself, he told them he was laughing at them, but it was a lie. He was laughing at me. That made him laugh again, and he said,
yes, I was laughing at you, because in fear of what others might report about you, you stoned the woman when your heart revolted at the act. But I was laughing at the others, too.
Oh, why?
Because their case was yours.
How is that?
Well, there were 68 people there, and 62 of them had no more desire to throw a stone than you had.
Satan!
Oh, it's true. I know your race. It is made up of sheep. It is governed by minorities, seldom or never by majorities. It suppresses its feelings and its beliefs and follows the handful that makes the most noise. Sometimes the noisy handful is right, sometimes wrong. But no matter, the crowd follows it. The vast majority of the race, whether savage or civilized, are secretly kind-hearted and shrink from inflicting pain. But in the presence of the aggressive and pitiless minority, they don't dare to assert themselves. Well, think of it. One kind-hearted creature spies upon another and sees to it that he loyally helps in iniquities which revolt both of them. Speaking as an expert, I know that 99 out of 100 of your race were strongly against the killing of witches when that foolishness was first agitated by a handful of pious lunatics a long time ago. And I know that even today, after ages of transmitted prejudice and silly teaching, only one person in 20 puts any real heart into the harrying of a witch. And yet, apparently, everybody hates witches and wants them killed. Someday, a handful will rise up on the other side and make the most noise. Perhaps even a single daring man with a big voice and a determined front will do it. And in a week, all the sheep will wheel and follow him, and witch hunting will come to a sudden end. Monarchies, aristocracies, and religions are all based upon the large defect in your race, the individual distrust of his neighbor, and his desire for safety's or comfort's sake to stand well in his neighbor's eye. These institutions will always remain, and always flourish, and always oppress you, affront you, and degrade you, because you will always be and remain slaves of minorities. There was never a country where the majority of the people were in their secret hearts loyal to any of these institutions.
I did not like to hear our race called sheep, and said I did not think they were.
Still, it is true, lamb, said Satan. Look at you in war. What mutton you are, and how ridiculous.
In war? How?
There has never been a just one, never an honorable one, on the part of the instigator of the war. I can see a million years ahead, and this rule will never change in so many as half a dozen instances. The loud little handful, as usual, will shout for the war. The pulpit will, warily and cautiously, object at first. The great, big, dull bulk of the nation will rub its sleepy eyes and try to make out why there should be no war, and will say, well, earnestly and indignantly, it is unjust and dishonorable, and there is no necessity for it. Then a handful will shout louder. A few fair men on the other side will argue the reason against the war with speech and pen, and at first will have a hearing and be applauded. But it will not last long. Those others will outshout them, and presently the anti-war audiences will thin out and lose popularity. Before long, you will see this curious thing. The speakers stoned from the platform, and free speech strangled by hordes of furious men who in their secret hearts are still at one with those stoned speakers, as earlier, but do not dare to say so. And now the whole nation, pulpit and all, will take up the war cry and shout itself hoarse and mob any honest man who ventures to open his mouth. And presently such mouths will cease to open. Next, the statesmen will invent cheap lies, putting the blame upon the nation that is attacked, and every man will be glad of those conscience-soothing falsities, and will diligently study them, and refuse to examine any refutations of them. And thus he will, by and by, convince himself that the war is just, and will thank God for the better sleep he enjoys after this process of grotesque self-deception. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 10. Oh, days and days went by now, and no Satan. It was dull without him. But the astrologer, who had returned from his excursion to the moon, went about the village, braving public opinion, and getting a stone in the middle of his back now and then, when some witch-hater got a safe chance to throw it and dodge out of sight. Meantime, two influences had been working well for Margaret. That Satan, who was quite indifferent to her, had stopped going to her house after a visit or two had hurt her pride, and she had set herself the task of banishing him from her heart. Reports of Wilhelm Meidling's dissipation, brought to her from time to time by old Ursula, had touched her with remorse, jealousy of Satan being the cause of it. And so now, these two matters working upon her together, she was getting a good profit out of the combination. Her interest in Satan was steadily cooling. Her interest in Wilhelm was steadily warming. All that was needed to complete her conversion was that Wilhelm should brace up and do something that should cause favorable talk and incline the public towards him again. Oh, the opportunity came now. Margaret sent and asked him to defend her uncle in the approaching trial, and he was greatly pleased, and stopped drinking and began his preparations with diligence. With more diligence than hope, in fact, for it was not a promising case. He had many interviews in his office with Seppi and me, and thrashed out our testimonies pretty thoroughly, thinking to find some valuable grains among the chaff
but the harvest was poor, of course. If Satan would only come, that was my constant thought. He could invent some way to win the case, for he had said it would be won, so he necessarily knew how it could be done. But the days dragged on, and still he did not come. Of course, I did not doubt that it would win, and that Father Peter would be happy for the rest of his life, since Satan had said so. Yet I knew I should be much more comfortable if he would come and tell us how to manage it. It was getting high time for Father Peter to have a saving chance towards happiness, for by general report he was worn out with his imprisonment and the ignominy that was burdening him, and was like to die of his miseries unless he got relief soon. At last the trial came on, and the people gathered from all around to witness it, many of them strangers from considerable distances. Yes, everybody was there except the accused. He was too feeble in body for the strain. But Marget was present, and keeping up her hope and her spirit the best she could. The money was present, too. It was emptied on the table, and was handled and caressed and examined by such as were privileged. The astrologer was put in the witness box. He had on his best hat and robe for the occasion.
"You claim that this money is yours?"
"I do."
"How did you come by it?"
"I found the bag in the road when I was returning from a journey."
"When?"
"Oh, it was more than 2 years ago."
"And what did you do with it?"
"I brought it home and hid it in a secret place, in my observatory, intending to find the owner if I could."
"You endeavored to find him?"
"I made diligent inquiry during several months, but nothing came of it."
"And then?"
"I thought it not worthwhile to look further, and was minded to using the money in finishing the wing of the foundling asylum connected with the priory and nunnery. So I took it out of its hiding place and counted it to see if any of it was missing. And then..."
"Why do you stop? Proceed."
"No, well, I am sorry to have to say this, but just as I had finished and was restoring the bag to its place, I looked up, and there stood Father Peter behind me."
Oh, several murmured, "Oh, that's bad," but others answered, "Ah, but he is such a liar."
"And that made you uneasy?"
"Oh, no. I thought nothing of it at the time, for Father Peter often came to me, unannounced, to ask for a little help in his need."
Marget blushed crimson at hearing her uncle falsely and impudently charged with begging, especially from one he had always denounced as a fraud, and was going to speak, but remembered herself in time, and held her peace.
Well, proceed."
"In the end, I was afraid to contribute the money to the foundling asylum, but elected to wait yet another year and continue my inquiries. When I heard of Father Peter's find, well, I was glad, and no suspicions entered my mind. when I came home a day or two later and discovered that my own money was gone, I still did not suspect until three circumstances connected with Father Peter's good fortune struck me as being singular coincidences.
Oh, pray name them.
Father Peter had found his money in a path. I had found mine in a road. Father Peter's find consisted exclusively of gold ducats. Mine also. Father Peter found 1,107 ducats. I exactly the same.
Oh, this closed his evidence, and certainly it made a strong impression on the house. One could see that.
Well, Wilhelm Meidling asked him some questions, then called us boys, and we told our tale. It made the people laugh, and we were ashamed. We were feeling pretty badly anyhow, because Wilhelm was hopeless, and showed it. He was doing as well as he could, poor young fellow, but nothing was in his favor. And such sympathy as there was now plainly not with his client. It might be difficult for court and people to believe the astrologer's story, considering his character, but it was almost impossible to believe Father Peter's. We were already feeling badly enough, but when the astrologer's lawyer said he believed he could not ask us any questions, for our story was a little delicate, and it would be cruel for him to put any strain upon it. Everybody tittered, and it was almost more than we could bear. Then he made a sarcastic little speech, and got so much fun out of our tale, and it seemed so ridiculous and childish and every way impossible and foolish, that it made everybody laugh till the tears came. And at last, Margaret could not keep up her courage any longer, but broke down and cried. Oh, I was so sorry for her. Now, I noticed something that braced me up. It was Satan standing alongside of Wilhelm. Oh, there was such a contrast. Satan looked so confident, had such a spirit in his eyes and face, and Wilhelm looked so depressed and despondent. We two were comfortable now, and judged that he would testify and persuade the bench and the people that black was white and white black, or any color he wanted it. We glanced around to see what the strangers in the house thought of him, for he was beautiful, you know, stunning, in fact. But no one was noticing him. So we knew by that he was invisible. The lawyer was saying his last words, and while he was saying them, Satan began to melt into Wilhelm. He melted into him and disappeared. Then there was a change when his spirit began to look out of Wilhelm's eyes. That lawyer finished quite seriously and with dignity. He pointed to the money and he said, "The love of it is the root of all evil. There it lies, the ancient tempter, newly red with the shame of its latest victory, the dishonor of a priest of God and his two poor juvenile helpers in crime. If it could but speak, let us hope that it would be constrained to confess that of all its conquest, this was the basest and the most pathetic.
He sat down.
Wilhelm rose and said, "From the testimony of the accuser, I gather that he found this money in a road more than 2 years ago. Correct me, sir, if I misunderstood you."
The astrologer said his understanding of it was correct.
"And the money so found was never out of his hands thenceforth up to a certain definite date, the last day of last year. Correct me, sir, if I am wrong."
The astrologer nodded his head.
Wilhelm turned to the bench and said, "If I prove that this money here was not that money, then it is not his?"
"Well, certainly not. But this is irregular. If you had such witness, it was your duty to give proper notice of it and have him here, too."
He broke off and began to consult with the other judges.
Meantime, that other lawyer got up excited and began to protest against allowing new witnesses to be brought into the case at this late stage. The judges decided that his contention was just and must be allowed.
"But this is not a new witness," said Wilhelm. "It has already been partly examined."
"Well, I speak of the coin."
The coin? What can the coin say?"
"It can say it is not the coin that the astrologer once possessed. It can say it was not in existence by last December. By its date, it can say this."
"And it was so. There was the greatest excitement in the court while the lawyer and the judges were reaching for coins and examining them and exclaiming. And everybody was full of admiration for Wilhelm's brightness in happening to think of that neat idea. At last, order was called, and the court said, 'All of the coins, but four, are of the date of the present year. The court tenders its sincere sympathy to the accused, and its deep regret that he, an innocent man, through an unfortunate mistake, has suffered the undeserved humiliation of imprisonment and trial. The case is dismissed.'"
So the money could speak after all, though that lawyer thought it couldn't. The court rose, and almost everybody came forward to shake hands with Marget and congratulate her, and then to shake with Wilhelm and praise him. And Satan had stepped out of Wilhelm and was standing around looking on full of interest. And people were walking through him every which way, not knowing he was there. And Wilhelm could not explain why he only thought of the date on the coins at the last moment instead of earlier. He said it just occurred to him, all of a sudden, like an inspiration. And he brought it right out without any hesitation, for although he didn't examine the coins, he seemed somehow to know it was true. Oh, that was honest of him, and like him. Another would have pretended he had thought of it earlier, and was keeping it back for a surprise. He had dulled down a little now, well, not much, but still, you could notice that he hadn't that luminous look in his eyes that he had while Satan was in him. He nearly got it back, though, for a moment when Margaret came and praised him and thanked him and couldn't keep him from seeing how proud she was of him. And the astrologer went off dissatisfied and cursing. And Solomon Isaacs gathered up the money and carried it away. It was Father Peter's for good and all now. Satan was gone.
I judged that he had spirited himself away to the jail to tell the prisoner the news. And in this I was right. Marget and the rest of us hurried thither at our best speed, in a great state of rejoicing. Well, what Satan had done was this. He had appeared before the poor prisoner, exclaiming, "The trial is over, and you stand forever disgraced as a thief." By the verdict of the court, oh, the shock unseated the old man's reason. When we arrived 10 minutes later, he was parading pompously up and down and delivering commands to this and that and other constable or jailer, and calling them Grand Chamberlain, and Prince this and Prince that, and Admiral of the Fleet, Field Marshal in Command, and all such fustian, and was as happy as a bird. He thought he was an emperor. Oh, Marget clung herself to his breast and cried, and indeed everybody was moved almost to heartbreak. He recognized Marget, but could not understand why she should cry. He patted her on the shoulder and said, "Oh, don't do it, dear. Remember there are witnesses, and it is not becoming in the crown, princess. Tell me your trouble. It shall be mended. There is nothing the emperor cannot do." Oh, then he looked around and saw old Ursula up with apron to her eyes. He was puzzled at that, and said, "And what is the matter with you?" Through her sobs she got out words explaining that she was distressed to see him so. He reflected over that a moment, then muttered, as if to himself, "Oh, a singular old thing, the Dowager Duchess. Well, she means well, but is always snuffling and, well, never able to tell what it is about. It is because she doesn't know." And his eye fell on Wilhelm. "Oh, Prince of India," he said, "I divine that it is you that the Crown Princess is concerned about. Her tears shall be dried. I shall no longer stand between you. She shall share your throne, and between you, you shall inherit mine." Oh, there, little lady, have I done well? You can smile now. Isn't it so? Well, he petted Marget and kissed her, and was so contented with himself and with everybody that he could not do enough for us all, but began to give away kingdoms and such things right and left, and the least that any of us got was a principality. And so, at last, being persuaded to go home, he marched an imposing state. And when the crowds along the way saw how it gratified him to be so hurrahed at, they honored him at the top of his desire. And he responded with condescending bows and gracious smiles, and often stretched out a hand and said, "Oh, bless you, my people." As pitiful a sight as ever I saw. And Marget and old Ursula crying all the way. On my road home, I came upon Satan, and I reproached him with deceiving me with that lie. He was not embarrassed, but said quite simply and composedly, "Ah, you mistake. It was the truth. I said he would be happy the rest of his days, and he will, for he will always think he is the emperor, and his pride in it and his joy in it will endure to the end. He is now, and will remain, the one utterly happy person in this empire.
But the method of it, Satan, the method! Couldn't you have done it without depriving him of his reason?
Oh, it was difficult to irritate Satan, but that accomplished it.
What an ass you are,
he said. Are you so unobservant as to have found out that sanity and happiness are an impossible combination? No sane man can be happy, for to him life is real, and he sees what a fearful thing it is. Only the mad can be happy, and not many of those. The few that imagine themselves kings or gods are happy. The rest, well, they're no happier than the sane. Of course, no man is entirely in his right mind at any time, but I have been referring to the extreme cases. I have taken from this man that trumpery thing which the race regards as a mind. I have replaced his tin life with a silver gilt fiction. And you see the result? And you criticize! I said I would make him permanently happy, and I have done it. I have made him happy by the only means possible to this race. And you are not satisfied. Oh, he heaved a discouraged sigh and said, it seems to me that this race is hard to please. Oh, there it was, you see. He didn't seem to know any way to do a person a favor except by killing him or making a lunatic out of him. I apologized as well as I could, but privately I did not think much of his processes at that time. Satan was accustomed to say that our race lived a life of continuous and uninterrupted self-deception. It duped itself from cradle to grave with shams and delusions which it mistook for realities, and this made its entire life a sham. Of the score of fine qualities which it imagined it had and was vain of, it really possessed hardly one. It regarded itself as gold and was only brass. One day, when he was in this vein, he mentioned the detail, the sense of humor. I cheered up then and took issue. I said we possessed it. There spoke the race, he said, always ready to claim what it hasn't got, and mistake its ounce of brass filings for a ton of gold dust. You have a mongrel perception of humor, nothing more. A multitude of you possess that. This multitude see the comic side of a thousand low-grade and trivial things, broad incongruities mainly, grotesqueries, absurdities, evokers of the horse laugh. The 10,000 high-grade comicalities which exist in the world are sealed from their dull vision. Will the day come when the race will detect the funniness of these juvenilities and laugh at them? And by laughing at them, destroy them? For your race, in its poverty, has unquestionably one really effective weapon. Laughter. Oh, power, money, persuasion, supplication, persecution. These can lift at a colossal humbug, push it a little, weaken it a little, century by century. But only laughter can blow it to rags and atoms at a blast.
against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. You are always fussing and fighting with your other weapons. Do you ever use that one? No. You leave it lying rusting. As a race, do you ever use it at all? No. You lack the sense and the courage. We were traveling at the time and stopped at a little city in India and looked on while a juggler did his tricks before a group of natives. Oh, they were wonderful, but I knew Satan could beat that game, and I begged him to show off a little, and he said he would. He changed himself into a native, in turban and breechcloth, and very considerably conferred on me a temporary knowledge of the language. The juggler exhibited a seed, covered it with earth in a small flower pot, then put a rag over the pot. After a minute, the rag began to rise. In 10 minutes, it had risen a foot. And then the rag was removed, and a little tree was exposed, with leaves upon it, and ripe fruit. We ate the fruit, and it was good. But Satan said, "Why do you cover the pot? Can't you grow the tree in the sunlight?"
"No," said the juggler, "no one can do that."
"You are only an apprentice. You don't know your trade. Give me the seed and I will show you." He took the seed and said, "What shall I raise from it?" "Oh, it is a cherry seed. Of course you will raise a cherry." "Oh, no, that is a trifle. Any novice can do that. Shall I raise an orange tree from it?"
"Oh, yes."
And the juggler laughed. "And shall I make it bear other fruits as well as oranges?"
"Oh, yes, if God wills, yes." And they all laughed.
Satan put the seed in the ground, put a handful of dust on it, and said, "Rise." A tiny stem shot up and began to grow, and grew so fast that in 5 minutes it was a great tree, and we were sitting in the shade of it. There was a murmur of wonder. Then all looked up and saw a strange and pretty sight, for the branches were heavy with fruits of many kinds and colors. Oranges, grapes, bananas, peaches, cherries, apricots, oh, and so on. Baskets were brought, and the unlading of the tree began, and the people crowded around Satan and kissed his hand and praised him, calling him the Prince of Jugglers. The news went about to the town, and everybody came running to see the wonder. And they remembered to bring baskets, too. But the tree was equal to the occasion. It put out new fruits as fast as any were removed. Baskets were filled by the score, by the hundred. But always the supply remained undiminished. At last, a foreigner in white linen and sun helmet arrived, and exclaimed angrily,
"Oh, get away from here. Clear out, you dogs. The tree is on my land and is my property."
The natives put down their baskets and made humble obeisance. Satan made humble obeisance, too, with his fingers to his forehead in the native way, and said, "Oh, please let them have their pleasure for an hour, sir. Only that, and no longer. Afterwards you may forbid them, and you will still have more fruit than you and the state together can consume in a year."
This made the foreigner very angry, and he cried out, "Who are you, you vagabond, to tell your betters what they may do and what they mayn't?" And he struck Satan with his cane, and followed this error with a kick. The fruits rotted on the branches, and the leaves withered and fell. The foreigner gazed at the bare limbs with the look of one who is surprised and not gratified, and Satan said, "Take good care of the tree, for its health and yours are bound together. It will never bear fruit again, but if you tend it well, it will live long. Water its roots once in each hour every night, and do it yourself. It must not be done by proxy, and to do it in daylight will not answer. If you fail only once in any night, the tree will die, and you likewise. Do not go home to your own country anymore. You would not reach there. Make no business or pleasure engagements which require you to go outside your gate at night. You cannot afford the risk. Do not rent or sell this place. It would be injudicious." The foreigner was proud and wouldn't beg, but I thought he looked as if he would like to. While he stood gazing at Satan, we vanished away and landed in Ceylon. I was sorry for that man, sorry Satan hadn't been his customary self and killed him or made him a lunatic. It would have been a mercy. Satan overheard the thought and said, "I would have done it but for his wife, who has not offended me. She is coming to him presently from their native land, Portugal. She is well, but she has not long to live, and has been yearning to see him and persuade him to go back with her next year. She will die without knowing he can't leave that place." "He won't tell her?" He will not trust that secret with anyone. He will reflect that it could be revealed in sleep, in the hearing of some Portuguese guest servant, some time or other." "Or did none of those natives understand what you said to him?" "None of them understood, but he will always be afraid that some of them did. That fear will torture him, for he has been a harsh master to them. In his dreams, he will imagine them chopping his tree down. That will make his days uncomfortable. I have already arranged for his nights." It grieved me, though not sharply, to see him take such a malicious satisfaction in his plans for this foreigner. "Does he believe what you told him, Satan?" "He thought he didn't, but our vanishing helped. The tree, where there had been no tree before, that helped. The insane and uncanny variety of fruits, and sudden withering, all these things are helps. Let him think as he may, reason as he may, one thing is certain, he will water the tree. But between this and night, he will begin his changed career with a very natural precaution for him." "Oh, what is that?" "He will fetch a priest to cast out the tree's devil." "Oh, you are such a humorous race, and don't suspect it." "Will he tell the priest?" "No. He will say a juggler from Bombay created it, and that he wants the juggler's devil driven out of it,
so that it will thrive and be fruitful again. The priest's incantations will fail. Then the Portuguese will give up that scheme and get his watering pot ready.
Ah, but the priest will burn the tree. I know it. He will not allow it to remain.
Yes. And anywhere in Europe, he would burn the man too. But in India, the people are civilized, and these things will not happen. The man will drive the priest away and take care of the tree.
Well, I reflected a little, then said, Satan, you have given him a hard life, I think.
Well, comparatively. Well, it must not be mistaken for a holiday.
We flitted from place to place, around the world as we had done before, Satan showing me 100 wonders, most of them reflecting in some way the weakness and triviality of our race. He did this now every few days, not out of malice, I am sure of that. It only seemed to amuse and interest him, just as a naturalist might be amused and interested by a collection of ants.
End of chapter 10.
Chapter 11 of The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Patrick 79.
Chapter 11. For as much as a year, Satan continued these visits. But at last he came less often, and then for a long time he did not come at all. This always made me feel lonely and melancholy. I felt that he was losing interest in our tiny world, and might at any time abandon his visits entirely. When one day he finally came to me, I was overjoyed, but only for a little while. He had come to say goodbye. He told me, and for the last time, he had investigations and undertakings in other corners of the universe, he said, that would keep him busy for a longer period than I could wait for his return.
And you are going away, and will not come back any more?
Yes, he said. We have comraded long together, and it has been pleasant. Oh, pleasant for both. But I must go now, and we shall not see each other any more.
In this life, Satan? Oh, but in another, we shall meet in another, surely. Then all tranquilly and soberly he made the strange answer.
There is no other.
A subtle influence blew upon my spirit from his, bringing with it a vague, dim, but blessed and hopeful feeling that the incredible words might be true, even must be true.
Have you never suspected this, Theodore?
No, but how could I? But if it can only be true.
It is true. A gust of thankfulness rose in my breast, but a doubt checked it before it could issue in words, and I said,
But we have seen that future life, seen it in its actuality, and so...
It was a vision. It had no existence.
I could hardly breathe for the great hope that was struggling in me. A vision.
Life itself is only a vision, a dream.
It was electrical. By God, I had had that very thought 1,000 times in my musings.
Nothing exists. All is a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, a dream, all a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space. And you.
I?
And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am but a dream. Your dream. Creature of your imagination. In a moment you will have realized this. Then you will banish me from your visions, and I shall dissolve into nothingness, out of which you made me. I am perishing already. I am failing. I am passing away. In a little while, you will be alone in shoreless space, to wander its limitless solitudes without friend or comrade forever. For you will remain a thought, the only existent thought, and by your nature inextinguishable, indestructible. But I, your poor servant, have revealed you to yourself and set you free. Dream other dreams, and better. Strange that you should not have suspected years ago, centuries, ages, aeons ago. For you have existed companionless through all the eternities. Strange indeed that you should not have suspected that your universe and its contents were only dreams, visions, fiction. Strange because they are so frankly and hysterically insane, like all dreams. A God who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones. Who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single one happy. Who made them prize their bitter life, yet stingily cut it short. Who have made his angels eternal happiness unearned, yet required his other children to earn it. Who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his other children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body. Who mouthed justice and invented hell. Mouthed mercy and invented hell. Mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied by 70 times 7 and invented hell. Who mouths morals to other people and has none himself. Who frowns upon crimes yet commits them all. who created man without invitation, then tries to shuffle the responsibility for man's acts upon man, instead of honorably placing it where it belongs, upon himself. And finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor, abused slave to worship him. You perceive now that these things are all impossible, except in a dream. You perceive that they are pure and puerile insanities, the silly creations of an imagination that is not conscious of its freaks. In a word, that they are a dream, and you the maker of it. The dream marks are all present. You should have recognized them earlier. It is true, that which I have revealed you, there is no God, no universe, no human race, no earthly life, no heaven, no hell. It is all a dream, a grotesque and foolish dream. Nothing exists but you. And you are but a thought, a vagrant thought, a useless thought, a homeless thought, wandering forlorn among the empty eternities.
He vanished. And he left me appalled, for I knew and realized that all he had said was true.
The End of the Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's Longest Touchdown Jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
What is Dax? Are you
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen. Yes, I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for.
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge. Trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.